From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when a four-year-old girl decided to write her grandmother a letter. Rebecca Amos is the youngest of six children, and her mother had recently taught her how to write. Young Rebecca was eager to practice her skills. One day, she went into her mother's desk, found a paper, pen, an envelope, and her grandmother's address, and wrote her grandmother a letter describing how her sister, Paige, was in the hospital. Paige had recently been in a car accident, and her mother did not want the girl's grandmother to know. She told her five older children not to share the news, but she didn't tell Rebecca, thinking that as a four-year-old, she wouldn't be talking to her grandmother, who lived in a different state. She didn't think the budding young writer would be sending her a letter at the age of four. Well, the Amos household soon received a call from the girl's grandmother, who wanted to know what was happening with Paige. While the situation wasn't ideal for Rebecca's mom, it marked the beginning of a lifelong passion for writing for Rebecca. She pursued writing in college and later when co-founding a school with her sister Susie, focused on passion-based learning as the model. In 2006, the sisters founded the Muse School in Calabasas, California. It's a plant-based, private day school where curricula are created around student passions. The goal is to encourage students to learn what they love, from wilderness survival training, fashion design, wolves, and it's really up to kids in many ways, incorporating concepts like math, science, and of course, writing. The school also emphasizes sustainability and global stewardship. Its goal is to be zero net energy, zero net water, and create zero waste. Muse serves children ages 2 through grade 12, and since its founding, it has grown to serve 200 students on a couple of campuses. And they'd like to take that model elsewhere. This hour, we discuss the passion-based learning model and its outcomes. We'll talk about if a model like Muse can be replicated and how to make quality education affordable and accessible to all students. And they are here in Rochester. They got an event tonight we'll tell you about in just a moment. Rebecca Amos is the co-founder of the Muse School. Welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you in studio with us. And Jeff King is the head of the Muse School. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Their event tonight, 6 o'clock at RIT in the Webb Auditorium. You can use parking lot F, and they're going to talk about the future of innovative education and why passion-based learning is just as important as academics in today's rapidly evolving world. So back to that in just a moment, but a brief interruption from my colleague, producer Megan Mack. Hello.
Hello. Last hour I mentioned we were looking for 50 new members as part of our first day of our fall pledge drive today. It's New Member Monday. You keep us here. You create and help support this very valuable programming on WXXI. And I'm happy to say that we are working our way toward that goal. Just last hour, we had one new member sign up just because she enjoyed listening to the discussion on Connections last hour, found it valuable, and said to herself, I listen to WXXI all the time. I am not a member. I should be supporting it. So she signed up. So if that's you, if you are out there listening to Connections, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, all the great things we do here at WXXI, and you are not yet a member, today is the perfect day to do it. Call 454-6300. Be one of those new members on New Member Monday. And if we reach that 50-member goal, a generous couple in Irondequoit has agreed to invest $2,000 to help us out and support programming here at WXXI. So 454-6300. You can also go online to WXXINews.org, WEOS.org, and help be part of this WXXI family. Evan?
Thank you. That's producer Megan Mack. Now, Rebecca and Jeff are here, and again, tonight at 6 o'clock, it's a chance to learn about what they're doing. And I think as we go throughout the hour, you're going to get a sense for that. And if you like what you hear, you might want to grab somebody and come on out at 6 o'clock tonight. How far and wide do you take this message, by the way? I mean, is this like a road tour? Rochester is just one stop?
Yeah, absolutely. It is just one stop. We are taking it. We like to take the message all over the country, but then all over the world as well.
Okay. So where else have you been recently?
We were over in Rhinebeck, New York, and then I was down in Manhattan. So I am kind of on this like tour of New York. So I've been able to talk to a lot of people all around the state.
Very good.
Yeah.
So they're coming in from the Muse School, which again, let's make sure that we know exactly what it is you're doing. And then we're going to kind of dive into the future of education. Listeners, this hour is a great opportunity to think about how we would imagine school if we didn't have some of the strictures that currently exist, if you were designing from scratch, because to me, it sounds like in many ways, that's what you've done. Is that fair?
Absolutely. We have absolutely designed from scratch. We started the school back in 2006, and You know, I like to tell people that we started it as if we were flying an airplane that hadn't quite been built yet. So we really built the school from scratch. We wanted to be an environmental school. So the idea was that we would be teaching kids about sustainability. And then we quickly became a school where we've really focused on children's passions. So the funniest question that my sister always asks is, what makes your skirt blow up, or what makes you dance in the street? And so this idea around, you know, what's your passion and how can we help you really follow that?
Getting kids involved in their own education.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, there's some listeners who are going to think you can't give kids too much autonomy. To some degree, they're not the boss. They're going to go to school and they've got to learn.
Right. Right? No, absolutely not. And, you know, it's funny because when I was early on, when I was really becoming interested in education, I started becoming very interested in a philosophy out of Italy, not Montessori, but it came from a region there called Reggio Emilia. Mm-hmm. And Reggio Emilia is all about child-centered learning and really letting kids follow their passions and really building upon their love for whatever they're studying. Like, where do they really get into the flow? And so for my sister and I, that was something that we really wanted to focus on for kids. Like, really, what do you love and how can we help you study that? And then how can we help you become educated around academics as it relates to your passion? So that was a really big thing for us. And then becoming sustainability natives. How do we teach kids? How do we teach them to learn about sustainability as it relates to their passions? Because once you're really loving something, once you're really focused on that, you become super engaged and it doesn't become, you know, like your rote memorization learning like we all had. So yeah, a voice and a choice and education, that's the goal.
So if I could ask both of you, kind of describe for me, if I send my child, and I've got a 7.5-year-old boy, mm-hmm. if he's going to the Muse School, what is the process like when you are trying to identify what a child's passion is and how you kind of want to incorporate some of what you're going to teach around that? He goes to school, and what happens?
Okay.
What's that process?
So I'll start, maybe let you chime in. Okay. So the student will start at the beginning of the year. We start in September, so we're traditional in that sense. And the teacher will meet with the student and say, you know, what do you love? Like, what do you want to study this year? What's your goal? And the student may say, you know, I really want to study Pokemon. I really want to study surfing.
You've met my son.
I have met your son. Absolutely. But exactly. And so how do we as a school incorporate academics through Pokemon? Or maybe your son doesn't like surfing because you don't live near the ocean. But and so how do we incorporate academics? And something we do at Muse is called the blueprint. So the blueprint is truly every child has their own blueprint. It's our version of a report card. Within that report card, the student will talk about their passions. And so it becomes a co-created document. And so the child will say, I want to study Pokemon, and this is how I'm going to get my science. This is how I'm going to get my history. This is how I'm going to get my writing. This is how I'm going to get my sustainability. So really it's about how can you show me your academics through what you love? And I don't know, Jeff, maybe you have, you want to add anything else?
Yeah. No, I think that's perfect. I think we take the academic content and we wrap that around the student passion. So whatever a student is passionate about, we can teach any academic content to. And the fallacy around autonomy is when you give students autonomy, they become autonomous. And there's study after study keeps coming out around the stress and anxiety that students have because of this rote memorization and because of this testing. And that's just not real life. And it's creating such a stressful environment for students. You just see, and we when we visit students, we just see them struggling and we see them really, I want to use the word oppressed by the curriculum and the way that education is implemented. And it's really tough to get people's brains around that. And it's tough to get parents' brains around that. And I like to use the term institutional memory, because a lot of times what we deal with is parents say, I was miserable when I was a kid and my kid should be miserable too. And that's what education is, instead of something that is autonomous, passionate, and where students love to learn.
Mm. Maybe to be a little more generous to the parents, I understand the point. Maybe parents would say, I was miserable in school, but sometimes that's what school is, and you just got to buckle down, and that's how it is. You go there, you're not going to love everything. You got to grind it out. You got to learn to do that. You may not love your job in the real world. You may not love everything you do, but you must learn to have the discipline to do it. What would you say if a parent said that, Jeff?
Here's what I've said the 1 million times that I've heard that. Because usually what happens when a parent says that is I say, well, are you in a job that you love and that you wanted to do when you were in school? No, but it pays the bills. Are you completely happy? No, but it pays the bills. And usually what follows every single tour that I've given and that what our staff give is that parents say, this is the school that I would have loved to be in. And so the paradigm shift that we're trying to lead, and we are moving away from the word progressive, and we use the word innovative. And I can talk about why we do that here in a little bit. But what I say to those parents is, we want to engage your students so that they love to come to school every day, and so that they are engaged in their educational platform, and they want to be here. Because if they're doing that, then when we send kids off to college, and we have kids at USC, UCLA, NYU, Bard, they are so engaged with their collegiate activities. And you don't hear them talking about, I have to do this to pay the bills, or I have to do this to grow up. They are living a passion-based lifestyle. And the other thing is, we also have to prepare students for this ever-changing landscape. Because the seven-year-old that you were talking about, the jobs that they are going to have someday, they don't exist yet. And some of these first, second, third graders, they may not see a truck driver. They may not see a live person in a grocery store. And so through automation and technology, students have to really be flexible. And we're teaching them as well.
So on the flexibility subject, a couple of things here. Number one, some parents, some skeptics of this approach might think, well, a 9-year-old isn't fully formed in what they're into. So you can't let them base the program because, number one, they haven't experienced all that much of the world. And school is a place to present them things that they might get passionate about as opposed to letting their passion drive the curriculum. And then they might also say, well, a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old or an 11-year-old, whatever, might be passionate in the fall about one thing, but come spring, that has shifted, and you've built all these programs around that. How do you address those ideas?
Absolutely. So what happens is a child gets flexibility every year because they get to choose at least 2 passions a year. So we can be flexible, they can be flexible. So for about 3 to 4 months, they do a deep dive into their passion, and we will fold everything into that. Say halfway through the semester, they're like, I want to change. Okay, so we take a look at that. We have a discussion with the child and say, all right, well, we've got about 2 more months left, so we can either stay on this or maybe you can transition into that the next semester. So there is flexibility, especially even with your younger child. So when you're looking at a 2, 3, and 4-year-old, they too are, they have like this kind of revolving reign of passions. Mm-hmm. So they're really looking at different passions. But we're able to really focus on that flexibility and help them help navigate that. But you would be amazed because they do get super, super involved in one. And then the next semester they say, okay, I'm ready to go over here. Some kids want to continue on with that passion for 3, 4, 5 years. And they go deeper and they go wider in that passion.
Forgive me, because I'm one of those parents who I try to remember that when I was growing up, video games existed. Mm-hmm. They didn't derail my entire life. In fact, I liked some of them. I liked SimCity and Civilization and, you know, fun games like that. But it feels now like a parent that there is this creep of screens and tech and the boys in particular in public school districts. And again, this is not meant to be an overgeneralization, but there's this Fortnite phenomenon. If a kid comes to your school and says, my passion is Fortnite, you're going to work a curriculum around that, or you're going to say, you know what, let's work on getting a different passion?
You want to answer that?
Yeah, and I want to back up to something that you just said, because there's something really radical that we do at Muse, and it's probably going to shock a lot of your listeners and may even shock you. We listen to students. And one of the most amazing things that happens is parents will come and they'll say, you know, I don't know if my kid's really interested. I don't know if they really have any passions. Or they'll say, my kid's passionate about airplanes. And we're like, okay. And then when that kid gets into our classroom and we say, what are you passionate about? And the parent's not around, it's like, so the problem is not trying to find a passion. It's dwindling that passion down. And so that's where the engagement process through passion-based learning comes. So a kid comes, and a lot of times, because I think screen times is the big crisis in education right now, so a parent will come and be like, you know, my kid is only into Fortnite, and the student will say, Fortnite. So what we're able to do is we're able to take Fortnite and take the screen time away from Fortnite, and there are mathematic lessons that you can do, there's writing, there's reading that you can do that doesn't involve any screen time. So you lean into that and you engage them in that so that Fortnite is not all about just a screen time. We've had students completely create video games out of pencil and paper and other objects in the classroom without any screens or any technology.
Okay. And what do parents tend to say with this?
They love that because parents are scared right now, I think, and educators are scared right now because of all the screen time. So when you can take that and you can avoid the power struggle and lean into Fortnite and lean into a Pokemon and some of these other video games and teach them how to learn about it with paper and pencil, then parents are ecstatic about that. And it helps them at home too, because kids are addicted. I mean, these first, second, third grade, they're addicted to screens.
I think there's also a piece, too, around the multi-dimension of a video game and being able to pull out the science and the history and, as Jeff said, the reading and the writing, even the sustainability, the environmental piece. How do we make it not just a unilinear thing? How do we make it this multi-dimensional thing that kids can go, oh, wow, okay, so this went into that or this went into that. What's the history of video games? You know, let's do some research around that. You know, what's the science? What's the social emotional piece? Like, what's happening to my brain too when I'm playing Minecraft or when I'm playing Pokemon all day, or what was the other one that we just said?
Fortnite.
So what's happening to my brain? You know, really teaching them about the science piece.
Well, we're talking to Rebecca and Jeff from the Muse School in Calabasas, California, which is where, by the way, what part of California is that for Rochesterians who don't know?
Yeah, so we are just about an hour north of Los Angeles Airport. When there's no traffic.
when there's no traffic.
Yeah. Right.
You're teaching starting at what age?
We start at 2 years old and we go through 12th grade.
So all the way up through traditionally high school.
Yes. And
it is, I guess we would call that an independent school,
yeah.
A private school, an independent school. This is where I'm curious to know if you think this model can travel. So first of all, how large are your average class sizes?
Our class sizes are 10 to 18 students. We try not to go over 18 students.
Okay. And with that, those blueprints that kids have based on their passions, teachers are trained to be versatile enough to say, your passion is hiking and your passion is surfing and this kid's passion is basketball and this kid, whatever the case is. And you're going to tailor and that teacher can be trained to sort of navigate and
yes.
kind of shift through them, yeah?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. I mean, the idea is also putting it back on the student. So, okay, your passion's going to be basketball. You're a fourth grader. All right, so how are you going to teach me science and history and reading and writing, sustainability? How are you going to show me that you can learn all of these things through basketball? So it's really put back on the student to make that out. So that comes into the blueprint so that when the student is working on that particular passion, they too can put their own words into the blueprint and say, you know, I could have done better in science. I could have done better in history, or, you know, I really knocked sustainability out of the park. But the idea is that, like I said earlier, it's kind of a co-created document, but it's also a 360-degree document where all of the staff and faculty are helping create each child's blueprint.
And passion-based learning is only one aspect of our philosophy. So our philosophy rests on passion-based learning, academics, self-efficacy, communication, and sustainability. And all the teachers are trained on how to implement that philosophy within each grade.
Those are your five pillars.
Those are the five pillars.
Can you do them one more time?
Absolutely. Passion-based learning, academics, sustainability, self-efficacy, and communication. And so the blueprint that Rebecca was talking about is about a 12 to 15 page document that's written in a narrative construct. And twice a year, the parent and the teacher and the student go over that blueprint document where the teacher and student explain those five pillars and they are assessed and on those five pillars, and that document is shared with the parents. The other thing that happens along with the blueprint is the culmination. And so think of your defense that you'd have to do for a dissertation. A first grader a fifth grader, 11th grader, at the end of each semester, they have to culminate and they have to present to the parent community how they have learned all five pillars and how they've incorporated all five pillars through the semester. And they have to get up and speak. They have to create presentations. They go through and they practice. Because one of the things that happens when we give tours is people are shocked at how a second grader can communicate and talk to an adult. And we have this rule when we give tours to our participants who are on tour. I said, your one objective is, yes, to learn about the Muse philosophy, but it's also just to be disruptive when you go into the classrooms, because that's what life is like. And so these students are disrupted, and we have people, so wait a minute, you're studying soccer? How did you learn third grade math around soccer? And the students are able just to rattle that off.
Very interesting stuff, but what about standardized tests?
What's that?
This is where being an independent school has its advantages.
Yes.
That's right.
And this is what I will say. So we've had our high school about for four years, and 100% of our high school graduates have gotten into the university of their choice, including academic institutions such as NYU, Barb, USC, where you have to take the ACT. So when you get to our high school, we have a college counselor who's in-house, and the college counselor walks through a four-year program with them that we call the U-Prep, not mom and daddy prep, U-Prep, Y-O-U. Where do you want to go to university? So if a student wants to go to a NYU type of school where you have to take the ACT and you have to have standardized tests, we can then wrap the curriculum around for that student so they can be prepared for the standardized test that they're going to have to take and be prepared for that type of academic institution.
But generally speaking, how do you feel about standardized tests?
I don't think it works. I think it's a 100-year-old philosophy that is about rote memorization that causes stress and anxiety, and students forget it right after they take it.
I think it also becomes a one-size-fits-all. So we all, you know, that whole method of learning is all about, you know, we're all going to do it the exact same way. And that's just not reality for kids.
In this country, the phrase, and maybe less so now, but boy, when it debuted, the phrase Common Core, you know, sort of elicited this knee-jerk reaction among a lot of parents of frustration and opprobrium. It actually united the country, no matter your political party. The creators of Common Core, some came from government, some came from the business community, and they had this idea that there should be this core of foundational knowledge that all students, whether they're from Calabasas or Portland or Rochester or Dayton, Ohio, they ought to have. And that we know that no matter where kids go to school in this country, they will proceed through school and learn these ideas. Was that the right or the wrong general principle? Is that the wrong idea?
You know, for me, again, I think you're putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. You know, I feel like that is just, it's once again, it's really focusing on that one size fits all. And we know that if you live in Ohio or if you live in Calabasas or if you live in Oklahoma City, things are different in those cities. But I also think we're headed into, well, we are in a future where there's so much diversity as it relates to learning, as it relates to people, as it relates to how all of us see the world, how we communicate. I think it's the wrong way to approach things.
Okay. And I'm sure listeners are wondering, do your kids take tests? Do you grade them? Do they get grades, letter grades?
So here's the thing. They do not get grades. We do not do tests. We might do something that, like we might do a check-in around spelling, but it's not a means to an end like so many tests are across the country and across the world. The blueprint, excitingly enough, that is something that can be constructed and translated into a GPA. So for a student who needs that, like needs it and requires it to go to college or university, we can actually translate that into a GPA, a grade. But we don't do grades and testing just for the sake of doing grades and testing.
One of the things that I look back at my own education and I think was missing, well, there was a lot. You know, I've said in this program, I mean, I think I was maybe almost 30 before I knew what redlining was. Before I knew what our history with, you know, certain practices that probably ought to be taught more broadly. I also don't think I ever had a lesson on, hey, that shirt that you're wearing, here's how you can figure out where it was made, what the conditions it were made in, and what values that would translate to. Not to say, by the way, that it's easy. Clothing manufacture is complicated and is a very difficult subject, but I wasn't even thinking in that way.
Right.
I wasn't taught to. Are the students at Muse taught to think in those ways?
Oh my gosh, they're taught, they're given the freedom to think like that, because that's the whole point of it is, you know, we've got this one idea, this one subject, this one passion, and then how do you just blow that up and become very comprehensive around the thinking around everything? That's the idea, because it becomes this project where you can look at it from so many different angles.
And I would add that the passion-based learning is one aspect of the school. And so the other thing that's happening within our classrooms, because we're not tied to standardized testing, is like last year, our second grade class, they created a business plan called Polar Posts. They wrote the business plan, they marketed it, they did the accounting, then they had their net and gross profit, and then they each got a share of the net profit that they went to the farmer's market and bought tomatoes and carrots and cucumbers or whatever it was. So we're able to follow student passions as a whole classroom, not just with the students. So students, and we also have students who are writing books. I would say almost 80% of our elementary students will write a book at some point throughout their elementary career. And it's fascinating. And they also get them published, you know, through independent publishers and things like that. So they're learning those things because I like to say we're playing a sophisticated game of follow the leader, and the student is the leader, and we're their mentor and guide.
In our second half hour, we're going to talk more about sustainability as a concept of Muse, how it really manifests, what sustainability goals. We'll answer more of your questions. So listeners, as we talk about this school concept, if it sounds radically different than what you're used to, I think it's probably supposed to. And our guests, Rebecca Amos and Jeff King from the Muse School in Calabasas, California, they are in Rochester today as part of their great North American tour. Got the t-shirt, did the tour, and Rochester is one of the stops. Today, 6 p.m. at RIT in the Webb Auditorium, they're going to be presenting on innovative education and many of the same subjects we're talking about today. So that's 6 o'clock today at RIT at the Webb Auditorium if you want to meet Rebecca and Jeff and learn more about that. If you got questions about how they're doing education and how you think maybe it should change or not, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Willow Domestic Violence Center is marking 40 years of serving local families. We'll be joined by representatives from the center who will talk about Willow and Monroe County's role in protecting survivors and helping them heal. We'll also talk about why rates of domestic violence are high, whether it's greater awareness, better reporting, or higher prevalence. Talk with you on Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're going to work through some of your listener questions now. So let's kind of just work through some of these. This comes from Linda, wants to know, regarding the Muse School, my children and I attended Montessori schools. I'm sure your guests are familiar with that program. How familiar? It sounds like the wheel might be being reinvented a bit, as Montessori is a proven method that largely involves students following their passions and learning along the way with passion. If your guests are very familiar with the two main Montessori program styles, what are the differences between Montessori and Muse?
So I would say that Montessori is definitely a program where a student can really be self-led, which I have always loved about Montessori. I think Muse is very similar to that. Muse, to me, is a much more, I used this word earlier, but multidimensional. We're really looking at the social-emotional development of children, and we're doing a very deliberate attempt at that. We're also bringing sustainability into the very forefront of Muse School. So I believe that our program is more multidimensional than Montessori, although I do think Montessori is an amazing approach to teaching young children.
Okay. Jennifer in Pittsford says, how are the students being assessed then? If there are no GPAs, then don't these kids have an unfair chance of getting into schools because you could technically construct a fake GPA based off of your personal assessment of them? And goes on to say, failure is an important thing for kids to learn and grow from. How does Muse incorporate that if there are no grades?
Yeah, so one of our pillars is self-efficacy, teaching students to be open, resourceful, and persistent. And self-efficacy is defined as my belief in my abilities to be successful. Studies around self-efficacy have shown that it is the number one predictor to a student's success in life. And it outpredicts GPA, it outpredicts where your background came in, your ability to believe in yourself. So there are multiple ways to assess students. At each grade level, we have academic standards for each grade level. Those academic standards are then implemented into the student passion, in which the teacher then assesses the academic content that is achieved during that passion project. And so if you take a third grader, there are certain academic standards for reading, writing, science, and science that they have to learn, and the teacher is able to give them that content as a part of their passion and then assess how they're doing with that. And let's take reading, for example. Let's say a student's passion is soccer in the second grade. We know the second grade academic standards for soccer. So the books and the materials that the student would read, the teacher would say are second, third, or fourth, or fifth grade level. And so that's the type of reading material that the teacher will give to the student. And again, we're a fully accredited school. And so I'm not sure how we would fake that. And then our students who have gone to universities, 100% of our students have been accepted to the universities of their choice. And those universities are looking at our blueprint and are looking at the process on how we transcribe and get the GPA out of the blueprint.
Okay. Do you agree with that statement from the caller who said failure is a part of life and that kids have to learn from that?
Here's what I tell our parents all the time. I would say, please allow them to fail right now, because if they can fail often right now, then they're going to be more successful when they're adults. One of the other sub-crises in education is, and you see this with parents going to prison right now, is parents are so hypersensitive to not let their students fail. And they're paying tutors and they're paying counselors and they're paying all these people so that they don't fall down.
And they can rig the system.
And they can totally rig the system. We want our students to fall down. We want them to fail. As a matter, I'll tell you a story. We do internships. And our college counselor was driving one of our students to an internship, and she came up into my office, and she's like, Jeff, he has a dirty T-shirt on, it's untucked, his hair's not combed, what do I do? I said, let him go to this interview, and let him screw it up epically so that he can learn why he didn't get the internship that he wanted.
Let him fail.
Absolutely.
I think
absolutely.
And not to make too much of an assumption about the caller asking about failure, but I think sometimes we think failure in school means a piece of paper with an F on it, as opposed to an experience of
right.
failure.
Here's the other thing I'll say here's the other thing I'll say about standardized testing. And here's the thing I'll say about grades. Grades can create a bullying atmosphere where students are comparing themselves to other people. So if I have a B and you have an A, I'm comparing myself to you, and I'm saying, in order to be okay, I have to get an A just like you. Mm-hmm. Where our students are have an efficacious environment where they're only competing against themselves and they're trying to do better and better than themselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I mean, it certainly does. But I think there's a culture change getting parents to accept that, as you've described.
Absolutely.
Right. That's part of the, and I think this next call will reflect some of that, because we've got email flowing in for our guests from Muse in California. This is Mary in Wayne County next on the phone. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, I am just jumping up and down with delight about your presentation, about your school, about your whole recognition of what life is about in terms of educating, and not just educating, not even using that term, but more than that, we are learners, and our whole of life is a kind of school, in a sense. When I was three, I was too impatient to wait for my mom to read the stories, so I taught myself to read, and then there was writing, too, and I've never stopped. I went my own way through school, and I, in some ways, socially suffered for it, for sure, because I was all by myself, and, you know, I was a strange one, speaking of diversity. So, but the most important thing that I want to say right now is I want to be in communication with you guys in the future and support it, because by the time I was age 7, I was trying to design a kind of nature-oriented schooling system. You know, and the mountains and the farms of Vermont, for instance, that was my ideal at that point. But and now I have grandkids, and they've all been schooled, homeschooled in different states with different perspectives, et cetera. And there's so much more of life that is accessible. And I'm just absolutely delighted by what you are doing and spreading the word. And I know it won't speak to a variety of people, but it will speak to others. So thank you.
Yeah, Mary, thank you for the phone call. So let's do a couple things here, because what Mary's excited about is what Rebecca and Jeff are doing. Rebecca Amos, the co-founder of the Muse School, M-U-S-E. Jeff's the head of the Muse School, and that's in California. They're speaking at RIT tonight at 6 p.m. about the future of innovative education. And ultimately, what's the goal? How far and why would you like to take Muse?
Oh, wow. I'd like to take it all over the world.
I mean, but realistically, what are you trying to do?
Realistically, I'm trying to take it all over the world. No, truly. I mean, the idea is that we are trying to connect these students with other students around the world who are really following not only their hearts and their passions, but also looking at the environment and the planet and really working in a world where we could use a little more consciousness and a little more compassion. And I really appreciate what Mary said, because I see her as being a person who was obviously a pioneer in her own parenting and now her grandparenting. So that's the goal, though. I mean, we would like to touch people all over the world.
What would you need to do to actually create Muse schools elsewhere?
What we would actually need are more people that love the model, that want to spread the model. Right now, we're already getting a lot of people around the world who are interested, which is why we are going this direction. So really, the idea is awareness and spreading the model wherever we can get it.
Yeah. We just started about a year and a half ago. We started an organization. It's called Muse Global. And we plan to start as many schools as we can around the country and around the world. We have our first school that's going to open in Redwood City September 1st of 2020. And we have many other interested partners where we're hoping. And we're going to start with the early childhood component of the school. And we're hoping to grow it from the early childhood school and then build on to elementary, middle. Because that's how the school started. 14 years ago, they had 11 students, and they had an elementary school, and now we have 200-plus students, and we're graduating them. So,
I imagine, whether it's Redwood or Rochester or otherwise, you need financial backers in these cities, yes?
Absolutely. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, you have to. And I think, so the financial model is, it's interesting. So, Rebecca and I spoke at this conference a while back in Paris on education, and it was about sustainability and entrepreneurship and business, and there were some pretty big industries there that spoke, and a couple of them had created sustainable products, but they weren't going to take it to market yet because they couldn't make enough money. And these were corporations that were making billions of dollars. They could have done that. But the concept that we're trying to tap into is you have to make money while you're doing good. And so our business model going forward for Muse Global is we want to connect with entrepreneurs and business owners who are going to make money through this model and do good at the same time. Because one of our pillars is sustainability, and that's the big crisis that our students are going to have to negotiate and that humanity is going to have to negotiate. I mean, there was a freaking tornado in Dallas in October, you know what I'm saying? And so we've got to figure out how to get this platform out there for students.
Well, and so given all of that, you know, to be sort of clumsy about it, listeners might think this is a fascinating model, but it's a school for rich kids. Yes or no?
Absolutely not. Our financial model for Muse is to provide a diversity, socioeconomic diversity. 40 to 50% of our students are on some type of financial aid. Interestingly enough, we don't do any full scholarships. It's an equity-based system, so every student pays an equitable amount compared to a family that would pay a full-pay tuition.
But if you're not doing any full rides, there's got to be some families who can't afford anything, right?
No, I would disagree with that. I would say on an equity-based system, there are families that can't afford something. And that could be, that dollar amount could be very low.
Okay.
And we have, you apply for financial aid and you give us your financial data. And then the system says they can afford to pay X. And that X is compared to what a full pay tuition is.
What is the full price for the families paying full?
So our early child is 22, elementary is 25, middle's 26, 27, and then high school's 32, 31, 32. We're pretty on in Southern California, we're mid to low as far as private school tuition's concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the latest around here, and there are independent schools. I think that would be on the high side here, but would that change in different markets, or would that number be fixed?
It would change, absolutely. I mean, I was just in Manhattan, and, you know, those high schools are running at $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when you're, I keep on saying Oklahoma City because that's where I'm from, but, you know, Oklahoma City, you know, an independent school might be $15,000 a year. Preschool might be $12,000 a year. So it's definitely going to change with whatever market you're in.
How do kids get in to the school?
That's a good question.
And how many kids don't get in?
They apply. And, you know, I like to say Muse School is for every single student, but it's not for every single parent. And so students come, they come for a visit, and we assess them. They spend about a half a day. And then I have two fantastic directors, Suzanne at the middle high school and Caitlin at the elementary and early childhood. They do a very comprehensive parent interview because we're really interested in what the parents and how they're going to participate in the school.
This is more of a parent vetting than a student vetting?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yes.
So how many parents don't get in?
All of them? No, I'm just kidding. No, I mean, I think that definitely can play into acceptance, you know, because there are times where the child is all in. We're all in with a child. But if the parent has a different feel for what they want for the student and it does not fit in with what we're doing, it's not a good fit. And we know that. I mean, we've learned that through experience.
And I don't have the statistics. I don't know what the percentage is, but I know one of the saddest things for Suzanne and Caitlin, when they come to us, to Rebecca and I, and they say, man, this kid would be an amazing Muse student. But parents are so, they want standardized testing. They want rote memorization. We just don't provide that.
They want 3 hours of homework.
Your first school in 2006, 2007 had how many kids?
We had 11. So we started in 2006 with 11 students, kindergarten and first grade.
And so if you end up with Muse Global,
yes,
Muse schools around the country and around the world,
yes,
you're going to go from that 11 to thousands. And it's going to have to be a culture change because,
yes,
you know, right now you can be pretty selective if the parents aren't sort of playing ball with the idea. You're trying to change a culture and the expectation of education. Yeah?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's where we're headed. You know, we've been at this for 14 years now, and it has not been a downhill battle. Even if there's a downhill battle, it's been an uphill battle because it's difficult. It's difficult to change people's minds. I mean, we are in an education system that's been going on for 100 plus years, and it doesn't make sense anymore. So the goal is to change that culture. We're doing it, and we're literally doing it one child at a time. And we're committed. You know, we are committed to make this happen.
Can you scale it up?
Yeah.
I mean, the best chef in the world can make you an unbelievable meal, and maybe for an extended family. And some chefs can do it for 200 people. For 2 million people, it would be hard to make the same quality meal.
Yeah.
Can you scale this?
Yeah, we can scale it. That's why we're starting with early childhood. And through our market research, that's where we believe is the best platform for us to start. And I just want to echo what Rebecca said. This is not a downhill skiing. This is uphill. And we have our naysayers, and I'm sure you're getting emails with naysayers, and we have naysayers in our community.
Surprisingly few so far.
Well, that's too bad. Naysayers, come on, you got to shoot us some emails here. come on with that. That's what I do most of the time. But it because, again, what Rebecca said was it's been around for over 100 years, and parents are conditioned to believe in a certain way. And the other thing is the test prep world, the ACT world, Sir Ken Robinson talks about this in his latest book, they gross more than the NFL. So these parents are taught to be super scared that if you don't get an X on your ACT, you're going to be a failure.
Well, here's a first naysaying email.
Right on.
Not even really naysaying, but Jim just says it sounds exclusive. It sounds great for those who can afford it. At the cost of $250,000 for a 7 to 12 grade education, how do you realistically make this intriguing model accessible to a broader demographic?
That's where the equity-based tuition comes in. So not every student is paying that. They're paying the equitable amount that their parents make for their income. And so it can be very, very diverse. It could be $500 a year. Depending on what your income is.
And you do have some students now paying almost that low, roughly that low, yes?
Yeah, we have it all over the board.
Okay.
And that's the goal. I mean, that was the goal when Susie and I started the school, was that we would have anywhere between 40 to 60% of our kids on some form of financial aid. That's key. That's key for diversity.
do you also need 30 to 40% paying the full ride to help support the school?
Yes, you do. You do need that. You also need, yeah, that's fair.
Okay.
Yeah, you want that balance. When you have diversity, you have to have both ends of the diversity. You can't just...
Audrey says, I jumped in halfway through this episode, so forgive me if this was already covered. I was unschooled, and this school sounds like a more formal version of unschooling, and I wonder if your guests agree.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I think what we're trying to do is untangle, kind of like what Jeff said earlier, we're trying to untangle what we've learned for so long and what we've been conditioned to know about, not know, but what we've been taught about school. So, yeah, absolutely, whoever just wrote in, this is definitely a more formal way of unschooling kids.
So building on Jim's question on the cost, we've got listeners who are wondering if a community like Rochester, which has really hard poverty numbers, and hard extreme poverty and child poverty numbers for a city of its size, unfortunately, the city is in the top five in each. Is this a model that just wouldn't work in the city of Rochester?
It would absolutely work, and you would have to partner with business owners and entrepreneurs to help get it off the ground. So you have to have people who are invested in changing education so that you could roll into this. And again, that's why our equity-based system, I believe, works, is because no one is there on a free ride. Everyone has skin in the game. Mm-hmm. And you do. You need the entrepreneurs. You need the business owners.
Is it possible that eventually... the MUSE model isn't needed if education changes enough in the way that you're nodding over there?
Yeah, I mean, if we could make MUSE schools, if we could make schools like this all over the world, we're really listening to kids. We're really changing the landscape of education. That's the goal. Let's innovate. Let's just change education. Yeah.
Before I get back to your phone calls, Jeff, Rebecca, tell listeners where they can learn more about the MUSE School online and MUSE Global.
Okay. So to learn about MUSE School, which is in Calabasas, California, let's say you want to move to California and bring your kids to MUSE, go to museschool.org. If you're interested in getting involved in MUSE Global, go to museglobal.org.
museglobal.org. And you can learn more tonight, 6 o'clock tonight at RIT. Rebecca and Jeff will be there at the Webb Auditorium at RIT, talking about the future of innovative education, passion-based learning, and more. This is Rick in Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Rick.
How are you guys doing today?
Good.
I couldn't help feeling a little ironicy hearing you say this is an uphill struggle twice. Well, that's entrepreneurship. I think one of the major keys that needs to be taught is that you're going to get hurt more than you're going to be good. And that's life. But to meld that with what you're attempting to do here, wouldn't an online platform offering these courses not only to children but to adults, which would boost your cash flow
go forward? Yeah, Rick, good question. Any online component that you would offer?
Yeah, we don't have any online yet. I think that's a great idea, and I agree with you 100%. We don't have any online piece for our school right now. And again, we're really trying to join in and trying to help parents and educators with this screen time issue that they're negotiating and trying to really reduce screen time. So,
Now you've got one teacher per grade at your school, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, and that'll change if you grow.
Yeah, at the early childhood level, we have two per classroom, just because that's state regulations.
So where does most of the funding, the money, the tuition go?
Teacher salaries and insurance. You know, we're seeing a 20 to 30% increase every year to provide health insurance to our teachers. So insurance, benefits, salaries.
It's a vegan school?
It is. We are a plant-based school, yes.
We like plant-based better than vegan.
We do.
I understand.
Yes.
As a talk show host, I understand.
Yes.
Is it the first plant-based school in the country that we know of at this level?
It is. It absolutely is, yes. We went plant-based back in 2015.
Why did you decide to do that?
Susie, when we started the school, we were an environmental school. So the idea was that we were teaching kids about the climate. We were teaching them how to live consciously with the planet. So by around 2012-13, we were starting to get a lot of information about how animal agriculture affects the environment. So how can we be an environmental school if we're still eating animal products? So we decided to go plant-based. In 2015, we completely changed. It took us about 18 months to transition. So we did it with pure environmental reasons in mind.
Can kids bring a lunch to school?
They cannot. They have kids cannot bring food onto the campus, we are providing all snacks and lunches to the kids. And the other thing is that we are doing a lot of growing those foods on the campus, so it's really part of the kids' curriculum to grow the foods, harvest them, prepare them, and eat them.
So we've talked a lot about passion-based learning and some of the model. In our last minute here, Jeff, just tell me a little bit more about what sustainability means and what you think it should mean in education.
Yeah. Sustainability should be a priority in education because our students are going to have to deal with this planet that we have given them. And when I say we, I'm talking about guys that are us old in the room. So teaching students about reusable products, how to recycle, how to compost, how to repurpose. I like to tell the story of a box. So one of the things that's unique about Muse School is when you walk into our classroom, there's no plastics, there's no laminates, there's no single-use items. Our posters, our calendars, our number lines are all made from repurposed cardboard. So when a four-year-old sees a box, they see one use for that box. It delivered a package. We deconstruct that box. They make a poster. They see two uses for that box. Then they flip that poster around, and they use the backside of that box, and they see three uses for that box. So we're teaching students how to think about sustainability in a different way. And Rebecca mentioned it earlier. One of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to create sustainability natives so that when you leave Muse School, you don't have to think about being sustainable. I have to think about it because I didn't grow up like that. I wasn't taught about it.
I'm the same. It's work.
It's work. But our students, it will be ingrained into their thought process and hopefully into their DNA.
I want to thank both of you for taking the time to explain the Muse philosophy. And again, listeners, 6 o'clock tonight at RIT if you want to meet them and learn more. Jeff King's the head of the Muse School. Rebecca Amos is the co-founder of the Muse School, bringing their ideas from California here to Rochester. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Right
thank
on.
You.
Thanks.
Really appreciate the time here. Our thanks to everyone working on the program today. I see Tim Shea back there volunteering, the super volunteer. A little wave. So humble. First time he's ever been called humble. Emma Ray Stein is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. When we say member-supported public radio, this is our fall membership campaign. I hope you are already a member. And if not, you can change that, and I hope you will at WXXINews.org.